Up next, a look at the trade discord between the U.S. and China and how it relates to the relationship of each to the developing world. This is from China's global TV network, CGTN.
The trade war between the world's two largest economies reaches far beyond their borders. We'll discuss how the U.S.-China trade dispute is impacting developing countries from Africa to Latin America. Hello, I'm Anand Naidu, and this is The Heat. There appears to be no end in sight to the U.S.-China trade war. Since July, Washington and Beijing have levied 25% tariffs on each other's goods, worth $34 billion. And in 2 weeks, each country will target another $16 billion in goods. U.S. President Donald Trump is readying 25% tariffs on $200 billion worth of Chinese goods. And China says it will respond with additional tariffs on $60 billion in U.S. goods. The U.S. tariffs on steel and aluminium imports from Canada, Mexico, and the European Union are also causing ripple effects around the world. South Africa says nearly 8,000 jobs in the steel and aluminium industry are now at risk, and its currency, the rand, continues to lose value. For more on the global implications of the U.S.-China trade war, let's bring in our panel. Here in the studio is Arthur Dong. He's a professor at the McDonough School of Business at Georgetown University. Also with us, Robert Moran. He's a partner with Brunswick Insight, a consulting firm on global opinions and market research. From Johannesburg, we're joined by Siya Beneza. He's a political economist and the finance and operations director at Political Economy Southern Africa. And Manuel Suarez Maya is a Latin America economic consultant and former chief Latin American economist for Bank of America. Thank you to all of you for joining us. Arthur, let's start right here in the studio with you. So this tariff dispute between the United States and China is escalating. The latest we hear is that the U.S. has announced more tariffs, $16 billion worth of Chinese goods. China, for its part, says it will impose counter tariffs. Now, we've heard about the effect that these tariffs are having on these two countries, the United States and China. But what about the rest of the world? Will there be collateral damage here?
Oh, without a doubt. As we see these tariffs start to take effect, there will be secondary and tertiary impacts around the world. As we all know, China is a nation that not only does a lot of manufacturing, but many of the inputs that go into the China manufacturing base are sourced from other countries all over the world. So therefore, a slowdown in the manufacturing possibilities for China will also mean that other nations will, in a sense, also feel the impact and catch a cold as a result.
Let's go to Johannesburg. Siya, as we just heard from Arthur, manufacturing is now a very complex process. We have complex supply chains all over. If we look at a country like South Africa and look at its automobile industry, for instance, South Africa exports key auto components to the United States. What will tariffs do to South Africa's competitiveness?
All right, so they've already estimated that at least 7,000 jobs will be affected by the tariff increase. Mainly our automotive exports, as you mentioned, catalytic converters being the most affected. But also our other manufacturing exports, such as household goods manufactured, such as microwaves, washing machines, etc., are also going to be affected by this, the tariff increase. And the worst is that we made a lot of compromises to secure our position in AGOA, which was supposed to give us special access to the U.S. market. But obviously, with these tariffs, this undermines this. And at the same time, it undermines some of the bargains and the trade-offs that we have had to make as a country in order to secure access to the U.S. market.
So how does a country like South Africa safeguard its interests? Do you now start looking at other markets?
Definitely. I think this will definitely push the South African manufacturers or exporters at least to look at least towards Eastern markets. Obviously, the traditional markets in terms of the EU still remain open. But more increasingly, especially with the signing of the Africa Free Trade Area Agreement, the African market seems to be a viable option, particularly for South African exporters. But it's a very difficult road to walk, definitely because it's very difficult to integrate some of the local suppliers when expanding the value chain into the rest of the continent, which is critical to ensure that the process of intra-African trade is mutually beneficial. So yes, with the tariffs in the US, the South African exporters will be looking towards Eastern markets, the traditional EU markets, as well as the African markets.
Manuel, we hear about how these tariffs could hurt developing countries, the negative impact of these tariffs. But I'm wondering, could some countries actually emerge as winners? Let's take Brazil as an example in Latin America. Brazil is a supplier, is a producer of soybeans, for instance. Mm-hmm. Could it take the place of those exports from the United States to, say, China?
Sure. To the extent that you have trade diversion, as it's called technically, trade that is being diverted from the U.S. To Brazil or Argentina, which are prime producers of raw materials and particularly grains and that sort of thing, you can expect that those countries will benefit to the detriment of the U.S. But the losses are much greater than the wins. The overall balance of cost-benefit analysis of trade wars is negative in the general spectrum. Now, there is a major difference between particularly Mexico and the rest of Latin America. Mexico is competing with China in the U.S. market. So we are more competitive rather than complementary, which is the case of Brazil and Argentina. In our case, in the case of Mexico, it's going to be far more difficult to diversify and to increase our exports to China to compensate for the exports that will no longer be going to the U.S.
You talk about the losses for Brazil. What are the broad losses for Brazil in a dispute of this kind?
Well, the broad losses imply that the costs of production, the breaking of the chains of production will affect their costs overall and their efficiency. Now, the case of Brazil is particular in the sense that Brazil is a fairly closed economy, much more closed than other economies in South America. So in a sense, being closed already affects them in a smaller way. So they have less to lose, which is the opposite of very open countries like Mexico, which have far more to lose.
Robert, the United States has generally supported free trade, especially after the Second World War. In fact, this country played a key role in writing the rules of free trade around the world. But when we look at these protectionist measures, how will it affect the main trading partners of the United States? Because the conventional view has always been that if your trading partners are prospering, then you get rich as well.
No, this is... at least in my opinion, one of the more frustrating things about this. It appears that America is having a short attention span and a short memory. At the end of World War II, both parties supported a globalization, a free trade agenda, with the idea that a prosperous trading world would be a less warlike world, and also with the goal of bringing allies together and integrating with them economically. And there was enormous success. People forget that, you know, a little longer than a generation ago, South Korea was an extremely poor country, about around the GDP per capita of Ghana, and it's exploded. And it didn't happen by accident, right? It happened because of globalization and free trade. And the whole strategy for America was to build up our allies and friends around the world with trade. We appear to be, or at least part of the American political system appears to be reverting to what it looked like in America in the 1890s, where you had the Republican Party as the protectionist party. I'm not sure that works as well in a globally integrated worldwide economy today. And I think that's possibly very difficult to defend. We have plenty of data around the world, not only showing that free trade has helped pull people out of poverty and pull countries out of poverty. We also have opinion data showing that globalization, especially in emerging market countries, is actually more popular than it is in more advanced economies around the world. So emerging markets do understand that this actually is a net benefit to them. So this is a very complicated situation right now. My concern is that the political feedback loop, we might take the wrong lessons from this and sort of mislearn some of the things that we should be learning in the U.S.
Right, talking about politics, Robert, what is the impact inside the United States? I mean, politicians like Donald Trump, they always have an eye to elections and politics in the country.
Right, and my background is in political polling. So the challenge here, I think, is that net-net, these trade actions are marginally unpopular right now. They may grow to be even more unpopular as some of the costs bite, and I'm not sure they exactly are. We see some data that just came out from the Atlanta Fed that suggests that U.S. businesses, at least in the Atlanta Fed region, are reconsidering some of their investment because of this. That's interesting. But right now, U.S. public opinion is split, but just marginally negative towards it. So 41% think that Trump's trade policies are a change for the better. 42% say they're a change for the worse. 49% say that increasing tariffs is bad for the country. 40% think it's good for the country. This is the problem of hyper-partisanship with almost anything at this point in time. With all that said, the support for U.S. farmers is actually, there's a majority support for U.S. farmers in existing polling. The challenge for the Trump coalition or the Trump folks is that on one hand, it's net unpopular for them in the United States. On the other hand, in some of the states they need to win re-election in the Electoral College, it could be popular. We don't know. Some of the agricultural red states, this could end up being unpopular and then hurting them. But this could be popular in Pennsylvania and Illinois and Wisconsin, et cetera. So the political calculus of this gets very complex very quickly.
Arthur, the Chinese president, Xi Jinping, he addressed the trade war at the recent BRICS summit in Johannesburg. This is what he had to say. Let's watch this.
A trade war should be rejected because there will be no winner. Economic hegemony is even more objectionable because it will undermine the collective interest of the international community. Those who pursue this cause will only hurt themselves.
So here we hear that statement there. Of course, he's targeting, it's directed at the United States, but China has pretty well established trade relations with countries of Africa, with the countries of Latin America. How is that relationship going to be affected?
Well, certainly with Latin America, with Africa, China has become the number one trade partner in these very, very large economies. And so what we will see, particularly with these resource-based economies, Brazil, Africa, Chile, they've been highly reliant and dependent on Chinese imports. In other words, China importing those mineral and raw materials for the conversion into building materials and et cetera. And so if China slows down with regard to its path of economic advancement, Africa and many countries, the large countries in Latin America, will most certainly feel the impact as well.
Okay, we need to take a break right now. More of our conversation about the U.S.-China trade conflict and its impact on developing economies. Stay with us. You're watching The Heat.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, communitypublicradio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.
Welcome back to The Heat. The United States is now involved in trade disputes with China, Canada, Mexico, and the European Union, and the African nation, Rwanda. The Rwandan government recently raised import duties on secondhand clothing from the United States in an effort to promote its own clothing production. The U.S. government responded by suspending Rwanda's right to export clothing duty-free to the United States. Rwanda is now exploring opportunities with Chinese manufacturers. Let's get back to our panel, and I want to start with Sia in Johannesburg. Sia, I want to get to the Rwanda story in a moment, but let's look at South Africa. And if we look at China's relationship with Africa in general, actually, it imports large quantities of raw materials from Africa and then exports manufactured goods to African countries. When we look at a trade dispute like this, could that pattern of trade change? Could we see a country like, say, South Africa start exporting manufactured goods to China?
Well, I think that's definitely a conversation that African leaders are looking forward to having at this year's FOCAC, Federation for Africa, Africa and China Cooperation, because of the developing relationships that China has with the governments, particularly as a financier of infrastructure investment. And so there's a strong call for China to not only support infrastructure, but to support the industrialization of African countries more generally. Discussions at the BRICS summit that recently happened in Johannesburg were also centered around this and how the countries can actually cooperate and benefit by integrating one another into regional value chains that are only or at least evident and mutually beneficial for all the BRICS countries. So definitely we might see that change in the future, but certainly not at this stage, given the surplus in terms of manufacturing capacity that still exists within China, despite the focus on its own internal consumer market. And so there's going to be very tight competition definitely moving forward. But where we might see African countries playing a significant role is in manufactured agricultural goods. So agro-processing, et cetera, seems to still remain a huge opportunity for African countries to play a role, given the surplus demand for food and the growing demand for food in China generally.
Manuel, you talked about Mexico a few minutes ago. If we look at Mexico, I mean, it's not collateral damage here. There are certain Mexican products that have been directly targeted by the United States. Steel, aluminium, for instance, 25% on steel, 10% on aluminium. How are those industries affected in Mexico?
Very badly. Very badly, directly and indirectly, because they are affecting the production of cars. Mexico, you probably don't know, is today the second largest exporter of cars to the U.S. We surpassed Japan in that slot. Canada is number one, by the way, and just by little, small amount. This is affecting the whole value chain in the car production and other goods that use intensively steel and aluminum. And you see the results of that already in the list of people who are asking for exceptions at the Commerce Department. To be exempted from these tariffs because it's affecting their competitiveness and their bottom line. So this is having terrible effects. And one other thing which is terribly complicated was mentioned before, shifting from one market to the other is very difficult and costly. Let me give you one little figure. In the 1970s, Mexico had a very anti-U.S. leadership, and they were bashing the Yankees all the time and so on and so forth. And they tried to steer away from trade from the U.S. 80% of our trade came and went to the U.S. Today, with a much more open economy, much friendlier towards the U.S., 80% of Mexico's exports still go to the U.S. The issue on imports has changed because now we import far more from China than we used to. China is number two trading partner of Mexico, and we have a trade deficit, by the way, something that to worry about, trade deficit that exceeds $60 billion. And you already hear the new administration people sounding exactly like Trump. We have to reduce the trade deficit. And trade deficits or surpluses are neither good or bad. They're the results of a set of situations and economic policies far beyond trade. But the issue is that it is already having a terribly negative impact on Mexican corporations, Mexican workers, as well as U.S. companies.
Robert, why impose tariffs on a country like Mexico on its steel production and its aluminium production? How does that help the United States?
Well, it's interesting. I think if you go back in time, there's a little, some history here. If you go back in time, you'll see that Donald Trump back in the 1980s was talking about trade and tariffs and this belief generally that other countries were taking advantage of the United States or getting the better of the United States. Interestingly enough, this is a long-held position by him. It was also the original position of the Republican Party when it was founded. So we're actually seeing a reversion back. The history here is actually even more interesting in that we tried this before. The United States tried this in 1890 called the McKinley Tariff Act. And that act was passed by Congress and signed by a Republican president in 1890. They then got crushed in the midterm elections of 1890, and by 1894 had been wiped out. They had lost Congress and the White House. Now, an economic panic put them back in charge in 1896. But, you know, they say that, you know, history, you know, repeats itself. In this case, it may rhyme, but we've done this exact thing before. It's easy to beat up on foreigners. It's much harder to build supply chains and then figure out how any of this actually works in a real way.
Arthur, we get countries in Latin America, countries in Africa supplying raw materials to China. You get countries in Asia supplying agricultural products, electronics, automotive parts as well. When you look at these tariffs, will they slow down? This is an economic term which is usually called trade flow. You know, trade flow is slowed down. What impact does that have on, say, the currencies of those countries?
Well, certainly, with reduced trade flow, the countries that are the exporting countries, such as Brazil, the currencies will adjust downwards as a result. It will have an impact on their currencies. As trade slows, that means there's less demand for their reais, and as a result, eventually the currencies themselves will devalue, and also creating a secondary impact, which is the difficulty or inability of them to repay their debts.
And a lot of those debts are owed to China.
Correct.
Because a lot of borrowing has come from China.
Correct.
Right, let me get back to Sia. Sia, we talked earlier on about Rwanda already feeling the effects of the U.S. trade war. The U.S. just removed Rwanda's privilege to export clothing to the United States duty-free. So what does that do to Rwanda's clothing industry?
So Rwanda doesn't have a very significant clothing industry. Nor does it have a very big manufacturing industry generally. But obviously, it does slow down exports from Rwanda to the U.S. But at the same time, with the signing of the Africa Continental Free Trade Agreement, as well as the economic partnership agreements with the EU that the different regional economic communities are signing, this then reinforces the traditional markets such as the EU, as well as perhaps Southeast Asian markets, although the Southeast Asian markets may be highly competitive and, you know, may not be a direct market that Rwanda wants to export towards. They still have the opportunity to export at least to the African economies as well as the European economies through the partnerships and the trade agreements that are being set into place now.
Manuel, we're talking about money, debts that are owed to China. I mean, if you look at some figures here, China lends more to Argentina, Ecuador, and Venezuela than anyone else. Its development bank invests more in Latin America than the World Bank and the Inter-American Development Bank. At the same time, Chinese demand for raw materials has fallen as well. Could that affect repayment?
Oh, yes. I think that China made the wrong bet in some of these countries. Look at the case of Venezuela. Venezuela is a basket case. The rate of inflation is approaching 1,000,000% per year. Their capacity to repay their debts, any debts, is vastly and very fast disappearing. Chaos is going to ensue, and we already have economic chaos. So they are not going to. China is not going to collect their money from their loans from Venezuela. On top of which, the production of oil in Venezuela has gone down sharply because they simply got rid of the people who knew how to do it. Something similar will happen with Ecuador, although to a lesser extent. The new government in Ecuador has been correcting many of the excesses of the previous administration. I don't see problems of that nature in Brazil. Brazil is a very large economy, and relatively speaking, the amount of debt acquired from China is much smaller than in the case of Ecuador or Venezuela. So, but I think that one thing that we have not mentioned, which goes very parallel to this, is the geopolitical impact of what's going on. The US of A is losing Latin America, which is now embracing China as a far more reliable partner. And this is happening even to its next door neighbor, Mexico, with a 2,000-mile border. So to the extent that you lose faith in the trust of a partner and you move towards other partners, it will take time and it will be costly to revamp everything, to make new alliances with other people who are farther away and so on and so forth. What will happen? And to that extent, the U.S. position in Latin America is being weakened, eroding as we speak in a very bad way for the U.S.
Robert, what's your view on that? I know you do a lot of political work on the U.S. influence around the world. Is that influence being lost?
Well, it's an interesting question. I think you can chart goodwill and goodwill towards America and perceptions of what I would call brand America around the world based on global perceptions of its leadership, of its president, typically. And so you had some negative perceptions of George W. Bush and a decline in positive views towards the United States, especially post-Iraq War. Then you had a huge increase in positivity towards the United States with the election of Barack Obama. And then you have a sharp drop with the election of Donald Trump. I think the Trump administration is doing some lasting damage to the brand of the United States, especially with some overheated rhetoric that does, I think, no one any good. And I think that eventually what harms the United States brand in the short run could in the long run. What you do on trade policy could also be pushing friends away. And I think that is, in the long term, worst interest of the United States.
Arthur, one final point, and that is, where is this all going to? Is this something of an aberration that we're seeing right now, that once the Donald Trump presidency is over, things will return to normal? I mean, if the rest of the world is looking at the United States, especially the developing world, are they just looking at it and saying, you know what, we're just going to have to bide our time?
I'm hoping it's an aberration, but I think there are perhaps some longer-term trends in place around the world. Yeah. We're seeing that evidenced in the EU, and certainly a greater amount of this being evidenced here in the United States as well, that there's a rising tide of trade skepticism among the domestic populations of these great trading nations. And I think there may be a persistence of this even after the Trump presidency is over. And so hopefully we begin as a world to develop greater clarity on what's going to, you know, proceed ahead.
Okay, and that's where we have to leave it. Thanks to all of you for being with us. That's it for this edition of The Heat. I'm Anand Naidu in Washington, D.C. Thanks for being with us.
And we close with the most recent press conference at the Department of State. That's last Thursday's press conference with Heather Nauert, who's the spokesperson for the Department of State.
Hi, everybody. How are you today? And why are so many of you showing up on an August afternoon? You're supposed to all be on vacation or something. But I notice a few empty seats. But Gardner's back from vacation. Gardner, welcome.
Hey.
How you been?
Good.
A couple announcements to start before we get started with your questions today. First, I would like to express our condolences to the victims of the recent earthquakes and also the aftershocks in Indonesia. The United States has experts and partner organizations on the ground who are consulting with the government of Indonesia at this time. We're closely monitoring the situation, and we stand ready to provide additional aid to the government of Indonesia. Our U.S. consulate personnel are assisting affected U.S. citizens. At this time, we do not have any reports of U.S. citizen casualties associated with the earthquakes. Our thoughts and prayers go out to the Indonesian people. As many of you know, we were recently on the ground in Indonesia and had some terrific meetings with government officials there. Next, I have some staffing news to bring you now, and I'm really excited about this one because it affects our Bureau of Public Affairs and specifically the folks that you will be working with. Today, I'd like to announce that Robert Palladino will be joining our press team as State Department's deputy spokesperson. Robert is a career Foreign Service officer, and I believe known well to some of you, or perhaps many of you. Over the past year, Robert has served as Director of Press and Acting National Security Council spokesperson. In that role, he's helped to prepare Sarah Sanders for her briefings at the White House. He was also a spokesperson to the White House Press Corps and worked as NSC communications lead for both Asia and Europe. Robert's Foreign Service career has included postings in Washington, where he worked for our Bureau of East Asian and Pacific Affairs, in the Office of the Undersecretary for Public Affairs and Public Diplomacy, and also on Capitol Hill. Overseas, he's worked in Milan, Italy, Guangzhou, China, and also Ho Chi Minh City in Vietnam. Prior to joining the State Department, he practiced law in Asia and Europe in the Army JAG Corps. His service included deployment to Rwanda. He's a graduate of Notre Dame University, Washington and Lee School of Law, the U.S. Army War College, and he also speaks Chinese and Italian. Pretty impressive. We are delighted that he's coming back to the State Department from the White House. I know you will enjoy working with him. For those of you who have not met him, he is a terrific guy. We've worked closely together for the past year or so. I asked him what his children thought, because he has two young girls. I asked him what they thought of his job, and I love these quotes. His youngest daughter said, "I'm proud of America, and I'm proud of you, Dad, but it sounds really boring." And then his older daughter said this, and you'll appreciate it. "But wait a minute, everybody yells questions, and they're angry. That's the worst job in the world." That actually might be the White House press corps, not you all. But we look forward to welcoming Robert when he joins us on the 20th of August. But try not to bug him between now and then. He's on vacation with his family. So, another addition to our press family. And that's it. With that, I'd be happy to take your questions.
Thanks. We'll try not to be so angry.
I said not you all.
Let's... Me. I just wanted to ask you briefly before I ask you about Yemen. I noticed the statement that you guys put out about Zimbabwe, the Zimbabwe elections and the Zambian decision to deport the opposition leader.
Right.
And in that statement, it said that you are reviewing certain aspects of your cooperation with the Zambian government. Can you be a little bit more specific? What aspects?
Some of those will be conversations that will be had privately with both governments, but my understanding is that there were certain agreements in which that government was taking steps that the Zimbabweans weren't completely familiar with and weren't supportive of, and there were some concerns related to that.
Well,
but let's just back up a couple steps for folks who've not been following this perhaps as closely as you have. Elections on July the 30th, those were promising, very promising. We thought it was a historic chance to sort of move beyond the political and economic crises of the past and toward a more democratic change and better dialogue in that country. People turned out massively in those elections. We put out a statement just after those elections complimenting them on those elections. However, the success in delivering Election Day that was peaceful and open to international observers was then marred by violence, which we've been seeing and has been heavily reported, at least in the international press, over the past about week and a half. We've seen a disproportionate use of deadly force against protesters by the security forces, which is a great concern of ours. We're concerned by those numerous reports of human rights violations since the elections had taken place about a week and a half or two ago. We have received credible allegations of detentions, of beatings, and other abuses of the people of Zimbabwe, particularly targeting opposition activists. Now, the latest news today is the former Minister of Finance had left to go to Zambia. Zambia returned him to Zimbabwe. We understand, and some of this is still fresh, so we don't have all the details at this point, but I understand he was detained and possibly let go. So I'm going to pause there because some of this is still unfolding, and I don't want to give you any inaccurate information.
I just want to know, is this a threat to withhold or suspend some aid to Zambia when you say you're reviewing certain aspects of our cooperation?
Matt, I'm not going to get into that at this point, but we're watching the situation carefully.
Right. Let me ask you about this airstrike in Yemen, which appears to have killed dozens of children. The Saudis obviously are the ones who conducted this, but they do that with weapons supplied by the U.S., with training supplied by the U.S., and with targeting information, targeting data supplied by the U.S. How can something like this happen?
How can something like that report happen? Well, yeah. I think we would start by saying, how can situations like this happen? You know, we don't have the full details about what happened on the ground. We've certainly seen the news reports of what has been reported happened. Okay, I can't confirm all the details because we are not there on the ground. We can say that we're certainly concerned about these reports that resulted, that there was a an attack that resulted in the deaths of civilians. We call on the Saudi-led coalition to conduct a thorough and transparent investigation into the incident. We take all credible accounts of civilian casualties very seriously. We call on the parties to take appropriate measures to protect civilians in accordance with international law and urge all parties to investigate all reported incidents of civilian casualties.
Okay, well, they say already, the coalition says that they acted in accordance with international law. But if you look at the photographs, the video that come from the scene, it doesn't look like that's a really, that's a credible answer. So are you okay with the coalition on its own doing investigation, or would you like to see some kind of an international component to it, or
well, I think I just answered that, and we said that we would call upon the Saudi government to do a full and thorough investigation, as we always do, and we call upon all parties in any kind of situation like this to take appropriate measures to try to mitigate the risk of civilian casualties. DOD and other entities put out reports on this after the fact as they all start to investigate. And so we will look forward to any information
on
that.
But my question is, you don't see a need for there to be something other than a coalition investigation. You don't see a need for an independent.
Matt, I'm not going to get ahead. This is something that is fresh, that just happened. So I'm not going to get ahead of any kind of investigation that may take place.
It's okay. Only the latest in a huge number of civilians killed during these operations, though.
I would encourage you to take a look, and that is, we regret any loss of civilian life. That is something that the United States government, in particular, anytime you talk to the Department of Defense about civilian casualties, they will say the same thing. I'm not finished, okay? And they will say the exact same thing, that all parties take very strong responsibility and measures to try to protect against the loss of civilian life. As we have seen, and you all very rarely ask about the issue that has been unfolding and the devastation that has taken place in Yemen. Let's look at some of the things that have been happening in Yemen. You have the Houthi rebels who continue to attack Saudi Arabia. They continue to do that with Iranian weapons, missiles, and rockets. They continue to try to attack civilian infrastructure in Saudi Arabia, for example, and that is part of the reason why these actions are being taken. Let me go back and remind you what I just said a moment ago, and that is we call for an investigation, and we anticipate that a thorough investigation will be done. I don't have anything more for you on that.
The Secretary isn't planning on having a conversation
with... I don't have any information for you on that. Okay. Hi, Nick.
Hey, Heather, is this the latest incident or the previous incidents causing the U.S. to reevaluate in any way the role that it's playing in the situation in terms of its relationship with Saudi Arabia?
Look, we provide a tremendous amount of humanitarian assistance in Yemen to try to support civilians in Yemen and try to mitigate against the devastation that's taken place there in that country. Yeah. I don't have anything more for you on that.
But you also supply a tremendous amount of weaponry and the data for targeting to the Saudis.
Well then, sorry.
Right? No? Am I wrong? Is that wrong?
Sorry, these ladies over here are laughing. On that, I would refer you to the Department of Defense that is involved with that. But you, as you know, Saudi Arabia is an important strategic partner in the region to the United States. Okay. Hi, Gardner.
Hey, so obviously there's growing concerns in Congress about the toll this war is taking within Yemen. It's the worst humanitarian disaster on the planet. Aren't you concerned that incidents like this will further erode congressional support and lead to further support for legislation that could cut off Saudi Arabia from arms sales and the rest?
I mean, I think that is an entirely hypothetical question, and we don't comment on, you know, congressional proposals. In any event, but I would ask, you know, all of you have been very silent on the issue of Yemen. And times, although Saeed has asked, you've been the one reporter who's asked a lot about Yemen and the situation there.
More than two briefings a week, and they lasted for longer than a half an hour, 40 minutes, that you might get questions about
Matt,
something other than
I think you and I talk every single day. You have my phone number, you have all my numbers, and anytime you want to talk about Yemen, I'd be more than happy to answer your questions and provide you additional expert briefings on Yemen anytime anyone is interested. But I have not seen a major level of interest on the part of our press corps, with the exception of Saeed on the issue of Yemen.
Why is that not a request in news today?
Yeah, certainly. So, I'd be happy to.
First of all, I think that when there have been attacks against Saudi installations or missiles and stuff, I think you've seen that there have been just as vigorous of reporting.
I disagree. But
it's not our job to, like, sit here and go back and forth on that. We're asking today, the U.S. has tried to increase its target training to try and improve the targeting of the Saudi coalition. Is that still continuing?
At least I think that would be a DOD issue, so I'd encourage you to talk with Mike.
Okay, but these are foreign military financing.
Yep, yep.
Which is it comes
and I would encourage you to talk to DOD about that.
Well,
so some of this is a State Department equity, but much of this is Department of Defense. So I'd encourage you to talk with them about it. Hillary.
Hi, I'm Iraq. Mm-hmm. The road between Erbil and Kirkuk, which was cut as a result of fighting last October, is being rebuilt. But Baghdad has said that it will establish a customs border on that road and collect revenues. Is that consistent, a customs border in the middle of the Erbil-Baghdad road, mm-hmm. in which one party, the Iraqi government, is going to collect revenues? Is that consistent with your view of a unified Iraq?
There are other countries that have done this in the past, including our own country years ago, in which this type of thing has been done. I think this is largely an internal matter for the government of Iraq, between Iraq and Erbil to try to work out. We do encourage them to resolve any remaining issues between Baghdad and Erbil.
And you don't have a position beyond that?
Look, we believe that a strong KRG government within a unified and federal Iraq is something that's essential to Iraq's long-term stability and the enduring defeat overall of ISIS.
Okay, if I could ask you about mm-hmm. Turkey. The deputy foreign minister was here. It seemed there was no progress. Is that the case? And were the American hostages the only issues that were discussed, or were there other questions like the Turkish purchase of the S-400 discussed
mm-hmm.
yeah. as well?
I mean, obviously, you all know that we have a very broad relationship with Turkey and a host of issues that we talk about with the Turkish government whenever we do meet. Yesterday, we had a wide-ranging conversation with Turkish government officials. We made it clear that Pastor Brunson needs to be returned home. Much of this, though, we're not going to negotiate in public.
Can you tell us if you made any progress about the situation of Pastor Brunson?
Yeah, I would say we would define progress as Pastor Brunson being brought home.
So
I think
no.
I'm so and progress until, is, until he, progress is Pastor Brunson being brought
so
home to the United
home, no
to
progress.
The United States. Yeah.
Did you give any deadline?
I don't have any information for you on that.
I
Thanks.
Mean,
Hi.
Progress is kind of coming closer towards an agreement. Like you don't have full North Korean denuclearization, but you say that there's progress in working towards that goal. So is there progress in coming, you know, to some kind of deal with the Turks? Or are you still, you know, as far apart
yeah.
as you were the day
I'm
that
not,
he was
I'm not
going
to characterize it that way. As you know, we met yesterday. They had wide-ranging meetings at the State Department and with other departments here in Washington. I'd refer you to those other departments that met with the Turkish government. The progress that we want to be made is to have Pastor Brunson return home, and I'll leave it at that.
So is
okay?
that a sign you will not engage with the Turks anymore on this issue until Pastor Brunson?
I'm not going to speculate on that, and I'm not going to get ahead of the administration on that issue. Hey, Said.
Thank you, Heather. Could you comment on the escalation in Gaza? There's been an escalating in Israeli bombardment. There is an escalation as we speak of Israeli bombardment of Gaza. Mm-hmm. Yesterday they killed a 23-year-old woman pregnant with her toddler. Do you have any comments on that?
Yeah, I mean, overall, we've been watching this as it has been unfolding, and it's a very concerning situation that has taken place in Gaza. I mean, overall, we condemn the launching of missile attacks into Israel and call for an end to the destructive violence. We've seen reports that 180 or so rocket attacks have taken place, shot from Gaza into Israel, and we fully support Israel's right to defend itself and to take actions to prevent provocations of that nature.
But this last round of bombardment and counter bombardment actually began by the Israelis. It was not Hamas that started this latest round.
Look, I'm not going to get into how this thing started. Let's not forget that Hamas bears ultimate responsibility for the dire humanitarian situation in Gaza. It's a tremendous concern of ours.
Okay, let me ask you about the peace efforts that are taking mm-hmm. place. Now, there are reports that the unraveling of the plan, the deal of the century, has been pushed back. Do you have any comment on that?
I would object to the premise of the question. Your statement in that question, we have not unveiled the peace plan at this time. That will be unveiled by Mr. Kushner and Mr. Greenblatt when it is ready. And when it's unready to be unveiled, they will unveil it.
And lastly, last week you guys released some funds or some aid to the Palestinian Authority. I believe it was sent to the security forces. Mm-hmm. Can you share with us the amount of that aid? Mm-hmm. Is that a one-time thing, or is it part of the sort of unfreezing of the funds to the Palestinian Authority?
I'm going to have to get back to you on that issue. I don't have any information for you on that today. Okay?
Russia?
Yeah, go right ahead.
Okay, two quick questions. First of all, on the sanctions that were announced yesterday, one of the requirements for Russia to avoid further sanctions is to allow inspections to make sure that they're not using chemical weapons. Mm-hmm. Does the State Department have any reason to think that Russia is going to allow that? And is the U.S. expecting Russia to allow that?
I mean, that's asking us to look into the future, and we don't know what the future holds. I think that's a hypothetical question, so I don't have an answer.
But the U.S. is fully expecting to have some kind of inspections take place then, according to this law?
I don't have anything for you on that today, and I'm not going to get ahead of anything that happens in the near future.
Okay, well, that's what the law says. But my other question is, is the U.S. then currently preparing for this next round of sanctions?
As you well know, we don't forecast sanctions. We have complied with the law in announcing those sanctions just yesterday, and we will comply with the law going forward, of course, as we always would. Okay? Hi, Gardner.
In the case of Iran, you have this 12-point plan of what behavior you want the government to implement in order to lift sanctions. You have a whole series of sanctions that are now revolving around Russia, having to do with Katsa, Magnitsky, now weapons. Can you give us some global sense of what these sanctions are trying to achieve from an American foreign policy perspective? Mm-hmm. What are you looking for from Russia? Why do we have sanctions on them? What's your goal? And when's the periodicity of these things?
Sure. I think I would start by answering that question with this, that we approach every country very differently. Every country that we have a relationship, or even countries that we don't have relationships with, are viewed through a separate lens. So what may be appropriate for one country is maybe not necessarily appropriate for another country. The United States government has determined that sanctions can be a very effective tool in trying to bring various governments to the table to negotiate with us or try to encourage countries to comply or to return to a better set of behaviors. So this is one tool that we have in a very big toolkit. The State Department works closely with Treasury and OFAC and other entities to implement, study, and enforce sanctions, and that is part of what you've seen yesterday. Let's remember that one of the things that has brought North Korea to the table is sanctions. And we have found sanctions to be very effective in many cases around the world. So the U.S. government looks at that as an overall tool.
Right, so North Korea is a great example. Sanctions, as a result, you want to get rid of their nuclear program. Mm-hmm. Again, Iran, you've got a list of 12 things. Venezuela, you've got sort of a clear list. I'm trying to understand what your policy is with Russia. You've got a variety, a myriad now of sanctions. What's your goal?
Well, I think the president has addressed this, and so has Secretary Pompeo. We'd like to have a better relationship with the Russian government, recognizing that we have a lot of areas of mutual concern. It is a major country. We are a major country as well. And so when you have that, you are forced to have conversations with other governments. And sanctions is a way that we can try to encourage better behavior on the part of a government. Now, I'm speaking broad in a broad-based sense, but that's one way that we can encourage better behavior.
Could I ask a follow-up on that?
Sure. What is your name?
My name's Emily. I'm from BuzzFeed News. Emily. You know, if these sanctions are in part meant to encourage better behavior with Russia, Russia today came out and said that these sanctions, sort of as was expected, that these sanctions are not in keeping with the spirit of Helsinki. So, and I understand these sanctions were in keeping with the law, et cetera, but does this, or to put it a different way, is the cooperation that was sort of established at Helsinki, is the U.S. government still planning on having that with Russia? after yesterday's sanctions?
We tend to believe that dialogue is always an important issue. I think I had just addressed this with Gardner, and that is trying to build a better relationship with countries that we need to cooperate with or we need to be able to have relations with, and that would be one example.
And then just on the other point on the second tranche, and I don't mean to get you into hypotheticals, but yesterday at the briefing, they did say that if Russia doesn't do certain things, mm-hmm. including sort of admit wrongdoing and say that they weren't going to do it again, that there would be a second tranche. And today Russia said, this is ridiculous, we didn't do that. So if they keep that position for the next 90 days, won't their under the law have to be a second tranche?
And that's why I would go back and say that we will comply with the law. We are well aware of what the law contains. We will comply with the law, but I'm not going to get ahead of what could happen 90 days from now. Okay? Janet, go right ahead.
Thank you, Heather. North Korean issues. Okay. And recently, South Korea imported the North Korean coal. What is the U.S. position on the smuggling of North Korean coal into South Korea? Do you think this is the South Korea has violated sanctions?
I think we'd say this, that we have a great relationship with the government of South Korea. Mm-hmm. My understanding is that they are looking into reports of this. We encourage all countries to maintain sanctions and to not, to not skirt sanctions and make sure that its sanctions are adhered to.
2 days ago, John Bolton, National Security Advisor, and South Korean National Security Advisor Jung Yong, they telephone conversation, and John Bolton said that he trusts or believes in the South Korean government. What does it mean that you trust the South Korean government?
The government of the Republic of Korea is an ally and longstanding partner of ours, and we closely coordinate with that government.
But allies, but they do something behind the United States, is smuggling something else. So how are you going to trust them?
Look, we trust when they say that they will investigate, that they will investigate. We closely coordinate with them. They've been longstanding allies and partners, and we have a strong relationship with them.
Are you still investigations?
I don't have anything more for you on that, okay? Okay, thanks. Kylie, go right ahead.
So there's been discussion of potentially having another meeting with North Korea. Has there been any progress on that?
We have no meetings, no travel plans to announce today. And by the way, we just got back from a long flight, which I will remind you, it was a very long flight. I headed over to Asia, a long flight back. We're okay with being here for a while.
All right.
Okay. Hi, go ahead.
Hold on.
Yes, first. Go ahead.
Sorry. So about the North Korean call, yeah. And South Korean government is going to announce the result of investigation about the North Korean coal smuggling, maybe later today. So now the issue is that whether United States is going to apply the second boycott to the Korean companies, which appears to be violated sanctions. So I just wonder whether you are going to apply the secondary boycott.
I think I just answered that the investigation was initiated by the government of South Korea, and we will await to hear from them on any announcements with regard to that. Okay, and we're going to have to wrap it up in just a minute. Lise, go right ahead.
Just on the idea, you said there's nothing new to announce.
Mm-hmm.
Are the delegations trying to get another negotiating session, like your team in Asia, are they trying to get another negotiating session together with the North?
I can tell you we continue to have conversations virtually every day, every other day or so
with
the North Koreans. And when I say conversations, that can be by phone, that can be by message, that can be by email. They take different forms, those conversations do. So we continue to have conversations with the government. If and when we have travel announcements to make, I will certainly let you know, but we have nothing yet.
Obviously that you'll make those announcements, but I'm just wondering if there's efforts being made to put together another negotiating session.
I don't have anything for you on that right now. Sir, go right ahead.
Just to follow up, you said you have nothing planned, but Mr. Bolton mentioned that in the letter that the Secretary Pompeo gave to Foreign Minister Reid, there was an offer to meet. Has North Korea responded to that offer yet?
I don't have any information for you on that. This was a letter from the president to Chairman Kim, so I don't have any visibility on what was actually in that letter or what conversations the White House may or may not be having. I'd have to refer you to the White House for anything on that.
So you can't confirm that there was an offer?
I can confirm there was a letter. Anything that the White House has said about that or Ambassador Bolton has said about that, I'd refer you back to them on those matters. When I have something to let you know, I certainly would be happy to. Okay, last question. Yeah.
2 days ago,
ago, President Trump claimed most Chinese students in the United States are spies. Mm-hmm. I'm not asking you to comment on what he said, but State Department as an agency to issue visa to Chinese mm-hmm. students, do you share the view? Do you think most Chinese students in the United States are spies?
Yeah, I don't have the president's comments in front of me. I have not seen those comments, so I would hesitate to comment on his comments without having read it and had the full context. As you are well aware, we have many Chinese students studying in the United States. We have strong people-to-people ties with the government of China, but of course there are concerns with some who might come into the United States and try to pick up some of our technology and other information and bring it back home for reasons that the United States government would be concerned about. But we have a strong relationship with China, and we enjoy having students studying in the United States from China. And I'll just leave it at that. Okay, thanks. We gotta go, guys. We'll see you soon.
Oh,